welcome to another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials, where we help you accelerate your career and turn soft skills into hard money.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials. Today, I have Matt Pieper with me, and we are very excited to learn a bit more about your journey. How are you today?
Doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Now, I always like to, you know, my listeners love learning about people and how they got to where they are. So we got a lot of stuff to talk about in this episode about AI, about its impact on people, about that strange sense of getting the benefits of knowing without the labor of learning, right? A lot of these things that you may have seen on Matt's profile. I'll include his LinkedIn profile in the show notes. I encourage you to follow him. He's got very interesting things to chat about, and he's an advocate for those in the Salesforce ecosystem to be successful and also to give some corrective, maybe reform to the way Salesforce goes about what they do. So let's go back, Matt. I always like thinking about, you know, when you were a kid, when did you see that tech was something that you might be interested in? Something more than, you know, just an observation.
Yeah, I think it's always a fun story and something that I've been exploring lately, right? As I've you know, switched jobs and careers. And so I think the first time I realized about technology, we actually had a Commodore 64 sitting on our, you know, kitchen table that we got from somebody, right? And for those who are way too young, Commodore 64 is a computer that basically hooked up to a TV and played it off of cassette tapes, you know, to actually do programs. And I think that was my earliest memory with tech, was actually we were playing Battleship, you know, my brother and I at a kitchen table, and then we were playing Battleship and we heard a big loud explosion outside and we're like, wow, this game's really amazing. Turns out like some neighborhood kids threw like a little incendiary device around, right? Just the right moment. And that's my earliest tech moment. But going back into there, right, it progressed, right? So Acer 286 was my first computer. You know, that was extremely slow, right? Like, I don't even think it had 4 megs of memory on the device, right? No CD-ROM, floppy drive. But that's how I got started, was, you know, playing with that, right? Resource constrained, figuring out how to play games, you know, that we get at Christmas, and progressing from there, right? I remember getting Windows 95, installing it in like Buddy Holly, playing it for the first time. I remember installing a CD-ROM for the first time, right? It was a cassette and you put the CD in it and then you pushed it in there. And now we don't even really have optical.
Well, you didn't think, right? It was a cup holder. So that was really progress. Right.
I mean, the guy at the shop very much said so. So, but yeah, that was it. Like, my father, you know, was a laborer, right? And, you know, his father was a laborer and that was our entire family. And, you know, his mantra was, you know, work with your head, not your back. And we can get into it a little bit later. I kind of ignored that advice for a little bit, but that's how we got into tech, right? And I remember the internet was very early, 4800 baud modems, right? I was way too young to be on unsupervised Wild West chat rooms, MIRC, back in the day. And I think through talking to people a lot older than me and figuring out what they do, right? Like, I started tinkering, and that was really my foundational, you know, moment, right? Was tech, just to tinker and loved it.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, you're willing to take a little risk there. And it's great. You know, one of my neighbors had a Commodore 64 when I was a kid, and I was always very curious. And that neighbor knew that and ended up giving me a Timex Sinclair 1000, which was a much smaller one. But yes, you hook it up to the television, you got to program something, and then you can run what you programmed. And so that was probably like 10 or 11 years old. And so, yeah, a lot of some commonality there. But I would like to talk about this journey, right? Because there's a lot of these lessons that you've brought to your contemporary, you know, kind of experience and what you're looking to do in the marketplace. Talk to me about, you know, when you didn't take your dad's advice of using your brain over your brawn, right? Where did that lead?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I was in high school and, you know, doing C++, right? And so independent study and, you know, just made my own, you know, adventure, right? Did that and realized, like, once I got to college, you know, my first day, I was going to be, you know, an engineer, and I sat down and people were studying and I was like, we haven't even started class yet. Like, what are you studying? And so I was like, okay, I'm gonna go over and be in finance and economics, right? Like I'm gonna use math, right, and all of that. But at the time, I didn't know what I wanted to do, right? Like I had ADHD and didn't know it at the time, right? I was jumping around, just doing whatever interested me. Like I wanted to be an audio engineer and tour with bands, right? And be a producer and those pieces. But September 11, 2001 happened, and that changed my career, right? I joined the military, didn't really know that what I wanted to do in the military, and was just like, hey, I'm going to join. My father, a veteran, was like, what are you doing? Right? Finish school and once again, right, be an officer instead of enlisted, right? Work smarter, not harder. And once again, ignored that advice and, beat up my body, right? And worked my back, right, for a decade and deployed. And I was still in tech, right? And still coding. It was still very much a passion of mine, especially, as the internet and Web 2.0 progressed. But I knew there was something better, right? Like I knew that I didn't need to beat myself up, right? And work, 12, 16-hour days, with my body. And so finished my degree. And that's when I was still in finance. And then I picked up a job straight out of 2000, I don't even know when, but it was the height of the financial crisis. And only job I could find was a software engineer for a coordination of benefits firm, which coordination of benefits, if you don't know, basically like if Aetna paid and your wife maybe had Humana, they should have paid. And so you're just doing this zero sum game of like shifting money between insurance companies, and didn't really like that, right? I was doing mainframe development and running these mining programs. I think AI could do it in a heartbeat now, but didn't like it. And so went and decided to get my MBA from Ohio State. Didn't know what an MBA was. I just knew, right, that very smart people got them. And I didn't know that rankings of schools mattered. So I ended up applying to Ohio State and got accepted in their full-time program. And same thing, right? Didn't know what to do. Everyone in class was like, I'm going to be a VP and ops. I was like, I'm just here to study and learn and meet people, right? And that's kind of what led me to the next stage, was my very first day in my MBA intern in my second between my summer, right? I was like, I'm going to be a venture capital analyst, right? Working for a VC. I'm going to be the next Andreessen Horowitz. And the very first day, they said, hey, Matt, you're an engineer, you know tech. Congratulations. Here's Salesforce. We just implemented it. No one knows how to use it. And that's kind of where this journey started.
Interesting. Yeah, well, I think they certainly saw that track record that you were willing to take on any challenge. And that's probably one benefit from coming out of the military, right? Is they just give you a job and you're willing to step in and be like, okay, I'll do that. I haven't done it before. I mean, I just finished the Alexander Hamilton biography, which is tremendous. And he had that as well. It was like he didn't have prior experience doing almost anything that he ever did. But when someone gave him an assignment, he went to work and figured it out and did an exemplary job. And so this looks like it was right in line with your prior experience. Now, what size? Tell me about that implementation. I mean, how many users were there? Like what did that look like?
Yeah, so you got to remember this was like 2011. So Salesforce was, 12 years old, right? Still relatively small as far as organizations went, right? Like I think it was only in Fortune 100s at the time and some SMB. So relatively small venture capital firm. So it's only, I think, 80 users at the time. But heavy integration, right? Because we were integrating across a bunch of other companies to ingest their data from our partner network. We did an annual or part of our survey, right? Was actually built out a survey and send it to our customers to get, not customers, but our portfolio companies, right? To figure out like what money did they bring in, right? What was the revenue? What was their headcount as part of reporting? So very small base from users, right? But it wasn't a traditional sales force. Like it wasn't going out and selling, right? Like it was internal deal management for venture capital and risk management and due dil. So heavy customized org in a period where you only had Visual Force workflow rules and Classic, right? Like, and you're still developing in Force IDE and Eclipse, and release notes were a book that you got at Dreamforce, right? That was printed out, and there was no trailhead, right? It was literally just me sitting there poking every day and figuring it out. And so I say that, right, because it's a small org, But even a small org back then was a huge org because you just had no idea what you were actually,
Well,
doing at
especially,
the
yeah,
time.
you're applying it to kind of a fairly non-standard use case there, right? Very interesting. Now, as you entered into this kind of the Salesforce world with this new assignment, I'm curious, did you have any cognizance of like what the Salesforce community was about at that time? Did you have any
No.
interactions with the Salesforce community back then?
Not at all. I kind of was in this little silo, and I think the important piece, right, is the implementation was literally a copy of another org's implementation. They literally just put it there and renamed it in the fields. And so luckily I had that person, across the state, right, who built it and maintained it. And so I was able to reach out to him, right, and start to network and learn those things. Stack Overflow was just emerging, right? So I had that community. But no, I think it was like the developer forums back in the day and those pieces, but there really wasn't like an easy way to like seek people out, especially, outside the Bay, right, or New York or Seattle, where they had meetups, right? Like there was just none of that then. So you had to search it out. And I didn't really know what like community was in Salesforce until like my first Dreamforce. And that's when I was like, oh, hey, there's a bunch of fanatical people out here who will, just scream at the top of their lungs at a keynote, right? And so that I always found that interesting because on the engineering side, like, we don't get that excited.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe an action figure on the desk, but keep the lights low, you know? Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. I was a software engineer for probably 15 years. So I get that. Well, interesting. So yeah, you made it all this way. Did you ever use SFXD? Did you ever hear about those guys? Yeah. They've been around for a while. So that's cool. Okay. And so as you think about right at this stage, it's good to have a little retrospective, right? So when you think about what did you recognize anything you learned in your prior days, whether in the military, any of these other things that you brought into your Salesforce role at this particular point in time? What did you bring forward that really, kind of inspired you and helped kind of guide your steps there?
Yeah, I think, it's always intellectual curiosity, right? Like diving in instead of just saying like, hey, this is how you do it, right? Like I wanted to know why you did something the way you did it, right? As an engineer, right, especially coming from that early on where you had to figure out hardware, right, and flip ICQ switches, and you were that close to the bare metal and you knew heap size limitations, right? Like developing in C and C++, right, on old devices. Like it wasn't the cloud, right, with this infamous, compute. It was like, okay, I can run on this very basic computer, and so my code has to be tight. I think those engineering principles plus my prior role was like, okay, this might be SaaS, right? But it's still a very, and SaaS was new, right? Like no one knew what that was, and cloud wasn't there. Like AWS was just emerging. It was like, hey, keep these same principles in mind, right? Like you're an engineer at heart, no matter like what the platform is, and keep that, right? I wanted to know why those heap limits existed, right? Like why SQL is the way it was written, why you deployed an XML at the time, right? Instead of JSON, like those important pieces. And that intellectual curiosity, I think, continued to drive me, right? Because I'd be like, okay, like Salesforce is a great platform, but, right, like how can I build outside of it? How can I leverage other pieces? And then from the military too, right? It's like breaking down a problem. I think a lot of people, when a P1 or a P0 bug come out, right, they kind of have that adrenaline rush and they pop and they, kind of shoot and try to gather everything. But the military, right, and paramedicine is like slow down, right? Slow is smooth, smooth is fast, like don't jump to conclusions, work the problem, right? And that has stuck with me no matter like what role I've been in, is just like don't panic. Nothing's on fire, right? Like you're literally not in combat, like no one's shooting at you. Like if a boss yells at you, okay, cool, like whatever, just keep calm and continue working the problem.
That's good on that. Slow is smooth and smooth is fast. I have another friend who's in the army and in the reserves now who says that all the time as well. I'm curious, do you feel that, as we kind of fast forward a little bit towards this, our current kind of era, it seems that this idea of this dichotomy of speeding up versus slowing down is kind of it seems like many opinions are being bifurcated between these two ideas, right? Whether faster for its own sake is actually progress, or whether it's actually going slower is actually progress. It's a very interesting dichotomy I see in our marketplace right now. Do you recognize that as well? Do you observe that?
I do, and I think a lot of it emerges from the classic line, right? Like go fast and break things. I think that line gets misinterpreted a lot, right? It's not go fast and break any everything's at all cost, right? It's go fast and break things where you can and where it makes sense, right? And it doesn't mean like literally break your entire code base. But when I look at having been through several iterations of tech, right? Early internet, email coming out, right? Web 2.0 and AWS and Azure, right? Those pieces, I've noticed there's always been like a steady kind of adoption curve, right? Like you have that come in, the tech, right? Everyone gets comfortable and you uplift. These days it feels frenetic, right? Because AI popped on the scene, like it erupted, right, without anything, and everyone started chasing it, kind of that FUD and FOMO method, and everyone started to say, "Hey, AI is the future," and it is, right? But no one really knows the core of it today. Like no one knows where it's going. We're in the very early iterations, but every single business out there is trying to move fast, right, to please their stakeholders, get revenue in the business. The world just moves faster, it feels like, or maybe I'm just getting older. But the tech's different, right? Like you look at the Salesforce platform itself, and in the past 5 years, admins have had to go from learning process builder to learning flow, right? To, even pushing in on dynamic forms on Lightning record pages to data cloud and
Yeah,
now
external
AI.
services. Yeah, lots of stuff.
Yeah. And so there's a lot more information coming at people who are on the ecosystem every day. And just from a learning side, right? But then also the feature side. Reps are moving faster, right? And wanting to sell faster. Businesses are wanting to integrate everything, more today and get different information. So you're getting this deluge of information, I think, from just a general landscape of as a tech practitioner, right? But then you're also getting that deluge of more work coming in faster, right? And maybe some smaller teams. So I think that's like my thing I grapple with, right? Is that cognitive dissonance, right? Your brain can only handle so much. And like, how are you going to distill that where you can actually learn something? And do you need to learn everything these days, right? Or can you kind of develop those T-shaped skills, right? And be very shallow across a bunch of things, but very deep in one. The question is, what's that deep one that you need to be in these days?
Now, what did you say? T-shaped skills?
Yeah, T-shaped skills. It comes out of Amazon, and I try not to quote too much AWS
Sure.
stuff, but the idea, right, is a person builds this T, right, where they know a little bit about everything across the top in their domain, but then they go deep in several different areas, right? And so like from an admin's perspective, right, you can know, user management, you can know, Lightning record page, you can know external integrations, like, and know that those things exist, know where to tweak them, but then maybe you go deep in the flow, right? And you're like, hey, I'm a big expert on flow. I know how the parser works. I know, here's where those things and that becomes your specialty. But then you can zoom back out, right, and know that flow works within a context of all of these other different components.
Okay, that's helpful. I like that paradigm. Now, one thing I'm curious, we talk a lot about, if you look at tech projects and why they fail, the top 10 reasons why they fail are all non-technical in nature. They're things like, scope management, communication, project management practices. There's certainly some politics and soft sabotage and all sorts of things that can get intermingled in there. I'm curious, given the fact that in your early life, you had to learn some of those core skills, right? Both in the military and some of these other things you were doing. What are a few of those that you feel like are just absolutely vital, just gold nuggets in your professional life today?
From a
Especially
soft skills
navigating, right?
perspective,
This,
or
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think soft skills is a common term. I think it gives it less credibility. So I like to call them like people first power skills, because then they really it gets people to sit up in their chair a little bit, rather than soft skills, which maybe be like backgrounded or superfluous. I think they actually are like the most critical things for people to gain, even before even they gain their technical skills, because they're really the cause of success or failure in a project. But I'm curious, as you look back, right, some of those aspects that you feel like you've retained and are just things that are tremendous partners with you.
Yeah, I think the number one thing, and this gets me in trouble in the business world, right, is in the military for the most part, right, unlisted, like there's politics and all that too. It's trust, right? And anybody can call anybody, not really out, right? But everyone's a safety, right? Everyone's looking out, like everyone has an idea in that plan and push back on the plan, right? If they say there's that misconception, right? Like, hey, take that hill, yes sir, no sir, right? No, it's take that hill and then coming back and saying like, well, that's not the appropriate way, right? Or like, hey, actually we can do that and get that feedback and input. And a lot of projects and features I see, right, it's the opposite. They come down and say, here's what we need to do, and they say yes. Really, that builds a area, right, where you become that order taker versus a collaborator. Like, I don't like the term internal customer because in a society, at least in the U.S., right, the customer is always right. And then you put yourself as a subservient to another person within the business. And really, to make business work, right, it's teamwork and it's having that collaboration and innovation. When only one person comes up with an idea, right, that's not innovation. Like, that's just an idea, and you need to have people to give that big and take. So I think it's having that honesty and trust is the big piece, and being able to be a trusted expert to say, this is wrong because of XYZ, and then I recommend ABC. Where it usually breaks down, right, is we say, hey, that's wrong, and then stops, right? And that builds an adversarial relationship versus saying like, hey, I want to get to where you are, but here's the constraints. Can we do this instead, which will give you that peace? I think the other skill is, I'm a big economics guy and finance guy, and it's like, what are we going to measure at the end, right? And having that ability to zoom out and say, like, here's what we're going to do, and here's how we measure success, right? Success isn't the end of an implementation. Success is adoption. Success is revenue generation. Success is, efficiency gains. And like, how do you measure those? And so I think that's those pieces. And then as a leader too, right, it's saying, how do I develop people, right? How do I give them the ability to push back on me and have the smartest people in the room? Like, even as a people leader, I always tried to hire people who were way smarter than me, because I don't need to be the smartest person in the room. I don't need to be the loudest person in the room. Like, have the other people around you who can build that trust once again and deliver better things, right? And have that idea. Like, as a leader learning from the military, right, it's all right, my job is to facilitate and take down, roadblocks. As a young sergeant, right, my mantra, the thing that was beaten in my head was beans, bullets, barracks, right? That's your job, as a leader, is make sure your people are fed, make sure they have the tools they need, and make sure they feel safe and secure. And I think those are the skills that I think make not only just a regular teamwork, but any kind of implementation or new feature, right? And I keep on saying trust, but it's really that trust. If it's somebody, pushing against each other or politics, like, doesn't matter what you're going to do, that trust isn't there, and you're just not going to ship to your highest, ability.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that trust spans a variety of different relationships, right? I think, certainly there's trust within you and your own team on your side, and then you and the client, whoever the stakeholder team is, and then the stakeholders, leadership, managers, and individuals among themselves, because their trust or lack thereof will significantly impact, all of our mutual success. So it's definitely an art and a skill to both smoke that out and to be able then to respond to it. And try and mitigate it and improve it while you're there, which is not at all a technical concern, right? Like you're not learning any of that on Trailhead, and so that's really interesting. So we spoke about kind of AI hitting the Salesforce world roughly July, August of last year, and the executives I've spoken to, I went to about eight different Dreamit events this year, and several of which said that Salesforce really just felt like they were late to the game when they got into this. And so it put them under some pressure, and that might, give them the benefit of the doubt on why we've all felt like we're being force-fed Agentforce for the last year. But I'm curious just on your perception over the last year of, just kind of what this picture has looked like, There's a lot of other AI players in the marketplace too. We're coming now, I believe, to the end of kind of this first iteration of AI, which was focused on automation. And I think we're emerging onto the second version of AI, which is much more about augmentation, which will be much more successful, I believe, than our current round. But I'm just curious on your what's your take over the last year as it relates to AI and our ecosystem?
Oh boy, you pulled the string on that one, didn't you, John? It's interesting to hear that Salesforce is late to the game. They feel that, right? Because for the last decade, maybe I felt, like we heard Einstein, right? Einstein, Einstein, Einstein. And for those, right, who don't go deep into this world, like we've had AI for a long time. Like it's nothing new. We had machine learning, right? You had natural language processing. Those are very much components of AI. I've always thought Salesforce's approach to AI and natural language just was always confusing, right? One, you chose Einstein as your character. Einstein, as a scientist, never touched AI. He never touched machine learning, never even, philosophized about it. And you paid, what, $50 million to the family for that name, for a name that doesn't even match the science, right? Like he was a
Should we
quantum
have used
physicist.
Turing instead?
I mean, Turing, like somebody, right? Like anybody from Dartmouth, right? Who actually invented the term AI and then Turing came on later, right? Or maybe right around the same time, 30s and 40s, right? Or anybody from Carnegie Mellon, like maybe name
56,
it the owl.
1956.
Yeah. And so that was always fascinating, right? So I always viewed AI at Salesforce's marketing, not, technical innovation. And then, we heard OpenAI come out, right? And what was that? 2023 was when the big boom, right, happened. And I remember Sam Altman being at Dreamforce, right? I'm like, oh, cool, there's a partnership there. And then the next thing I know, Sam Altman was at Microsoft. And then, with OpenAI, right? And then Agentforce popped out. And then we had Agentforce 1, 2, and 3 as major releases, within shorter time. So all that to say is it feels different, right? Like I look at other corporations and how they've layered out AI, and it's been very much an augmentation of their platforms and not this core piece. I look at how Dream, Agentforce is rolled out, right? And it was like agents, agents, agents. I remember sitting at Dreamforce booth, right? And Prompt Builder. And this was before Agentforce, right? So that would have been Dreamforce 2023. And I remember just sitting for an hour at the Prompt Builder booth, the product manager booth, and just listening to people and the questions they asked. And I remember sitting there going, woof. People don't understand prompts at all or what they are. Like we are in trouble, right? Like you had people every day who, they had just gotten hit with flows and they were still drowning. But then people were like, how, like, what is a prompt? Like, what does it do? Like, how do I structure it? Like, why do I do this? Right. And those pieces. And then I watched for that next year, right? And went to TDX. And I didn't see in the ecosystem people like really getting it or latching on. And then that's why I was surprised at Dreamforce last year, right, with Agentforce. I was like, whoa, this escalated quickly. And I remember sitting once again at the booths, right? People were like, well, how does this work, right? Like, how does that prompt build? Like, do I need flow? Do I need this? I watch people stumble at the clicks. And so I remember distinctly going, like, admins are in trouble. Like, they're going to have a lot to learn and they're going to have a lot of pressure coming from their leadership to adopt this. And what is their answer going to be? Right. Like, I have a buddy who's a solo admin. I traveled to every Dreamforce with him and he looked at me and he's like, Matt, if you're struggling with this, like, what do you think I'm doing right now? Right. Like, he's like, I don't know what to do when I go back to my bosses. And I feel like that messaging has been lost. Right. Like, we're pushing the sales very fast on Agentforce, right, and Data Cloud. But I'm not seeing much upskilling, right? Like, yeah, you have the trailheads out there right now, but like, what's the actual real world implications and security and those pieces? So it's been an interesting journey. I don't think anything's really wrong, right? There's different approaches. What I would have liked to see is kind of what they did with Zoho, right? Where put those tools in place in front of people, right? That gets them comfortable with AI, right? Like they can say, query their database, right, and return results, or quickly say, hey, how does this flow work? And those pieces, put it into everybody's hands, get them used to just what the tool is, its limitations, what it can and can't do, and then push a lot of the agentic stuff. I do want to give grace to Mark and the team, right? Because I've never ran a Fortune 500. I've never, had 75,000 or 175,000 employees report to me, and I've never had, reported to Wall Street. So I know there's a lot of internal pressures and pieces like that. But, who's the customer at the end of the day, right? Like who built, the ecosystem, who built the success? And I felt like that kind of went a different way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's I'm not planning to go to Dreamforce this year. Are you?
This will be my last one after I think this is 14 for me, and that's it.
That's it. So tell me more. Like, what does that mean? How are you punctuating it?
I wasn't gonna go this year, and then I was like, well, Matt, you need a last hurrah, right? Like you just need to, it's like the baseball player, right, rounding the bases for the last time, right? Like this has been such a critical, not critical, but such a big part of my life for since 2011, right? And my first one, right? And TDX and those. And I realized last year that it was so sales heavy that and only focused on one area, right? Like I didn't hear anything about RCA. I didn't hear, and that was replacing CPQ, right? I didn't hear anything about the problems that admins and developers are facing every single day, and business analysts, right? And their orgs and managers, right? And how to fix those. It was all Agentforce all the time. And so this year I was like, am I really going to go through that again? But I realized like I need to meet my friends, right? I need to talk to people. I'm starting a new venture and need to network and really just take that lap, right? I think all that money too that I spend on Dreamforce, because every year I've been out of pocket, like just go to Dreamin events, right? Or do other things in the
Yeah,
community and
agreed.
give that where I can actually like learn from others versus getting slammed over the head with something that honestly I don't have any in my orgs. And this is a Salesforce centric, right? But I'm going to choose other AI products out there to drive my automation, right? Because I don't just have Salesforce, right? And my clients, I have finance programs, I have their, ERP, I have their OMS, and each one of those has a different flavor. And as a product developer, even like we have AI in our product, why am I going to buy one tool from each one of these vendors and stack up that cost, which is what we've been doing for 26 years, when I can find a platform agnostic AI tool that can automate all the way across and orchestrate that? And that's what I expected Agentforce to be, right? A third-party tool, like maybe a MuleSoft, right? Where you don't even need Salesforce to drive it, right? Like this, like it's the N8N, of the worlds and fancy. So yeah, this is my last Dreamforce. And I'm not a crier, but I might weep a little tear at Dreamfest as I see Metallica leave the stage.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about your new venture in a sec here, but I want to zoom out a bit to think about, because there's many listeners, right? Certainly, they're in the Salesforce ecosystem, but in the same way, they're dealing with mature organizations have, the whole constellation of systems. One of the bright stars is often Salesforce, but there are many, many other things out there. And so I'm curious, as you think of, kind of AI as it's coming and impacting, the technical ecosystem as well as just our society. I want to get a little picture of kind of what your perspective is on, kind of the benefits, trade-offs, maybe some, ways of thinking about it and just where you perceive the future to be.
Yeah, it's funny. Like people say, like I'm anti-AI. I'm like, no, I'm not anti-AI. I think it's a tool just like any other tool, right? We just have to be responsible and understand the ecosystem and its pros and cons. I often draw the corollary right to social media. We knew the dangers of social media coming out, right? And the addictions and the levers, right? They pull to keep us hooked, right? And keep that dopamine. We knew about the massive amounts of data collection, right? And we celebrated them and said, hey, look, right? Facebook's so amazing. Like they know exactly who I am. And this ad is exactly for me. We thought that was so cool, right? Fast forward now, and we're like, oh crap, everyone knows everything about me to the entire T. And this mobile device that I carry in my pocket is literally a tracker where they have those IP addresses and can track your every single movement, right? And sell that to people, right? Like, oh, Matt goes to this location day in and day out. I use that, right? Because I see that a lot with AI now. Like, wow, AI has memory. Like, wow, AI can do this. Ooh, look at this, right? But what are they doing with that data, right? We know that OpenAI and others are hemorrhaging cash, right? They're literally staying afloat by venture capital. Their model doesn't sustain. how do they get their revenue, right? Like, it's likely ads, right? And how are they going to use those ads? Well, all the crap you type into your AI, your sensitive thoughts, right? Your medical diagnoses, your therapy, you're breaking up with your boyfriend, right? Like, people say, like, oh yeah, Matt, like, but there's the trust layer, right? Or their privacy and security. Like, cool. Uber had that too. And then they tracked all of their, rivals on their phones, right? Like, we have to understand that terms and words are legalese, right? When you have money to deploy, you can exploit those. And so I'm not anti-AI. I'm very much like, everybody, we need to dial the hype down a little bit, just a little bit, and start talking about the real things, right? Like, what is this impact happening? Not just in those, right? But as an ADHD person, right? Like, task switching constantly, right? I'm waiting for this thing to happen, so I'm gonna go over to here, and I'm gonna go back over here. Like, I feel myself getting fueled by that sometimes, right? And I'm like, whoa, I feel a little bit more overstimulated than I ever did, hyper focusing. There's also, the pollution risk, right? Like, we're looking at the city of Memphis, right? With data centers and the power, right, that are pumping pollution. And because the city didn't want it, right, but the state didn't want it, and regulations and yada. So, like, are we hampering the power grid already when we have states like Texas, right, who are already struggling? The electric car movement, the experts and the electricians, right, were saying, like, our grid can't handle all these electric cars. And now we're pumping even more data centers. I think I heard a story yesterday, like, 5,400 data centers are opening this year. Like, that's really insane, right? And, like, where is all that power going to come from? So there is that side, right? And there's the, are we making ourselves dumber, right? Because the studies show, right, like, when you delegate parts of your brain, right, like, that doesn't happen. Like, critical thinking is what keeps us from getting dementia and Alzheimer's for, most of the studies, right? Like, yeah, it's the calculator argument, but the calculator argument did just a little bit of math, right? Like, we're talking about every single thing we do. And I'll argue, like, the calculator also holds us back. Like, I watched somebody the other day ask, their AI assistant what 150 divided by 2 was. And I was like, 75, right? Like, you took longer to do that. Like, just have that skill. But on the other hand, right, as an 80 person with ADHD and neurodivergent, like, my favorite app is Saner, right? Like, it's my second brain. I just type stuff into it and it organizes and tags it. I don't have to worry about getting overwhelmed with how I organize folders and tags so I can find them later. I just dictate to it, type it in meetings, and then go forward, right? So I think there's a lot of pros, even in diagnosis, right? In medicine, being able to find new, creatures we never had before. But I think we have to have that balanced conversation, and I don't see that balanced conversation happening. I also think we need to be skeptical of the people who make the software, right? Because a lot of the times you'll hear it, like, but Sam Altman says we're going to replace developers in 4 years. Like, okay, use your critical thinking skills, right? Like, why would Sam Altman say that, right? It benefits him, right? And
He's
so, like,
fundraising.
now, yeah. And, like, what does a leading AI expert in the field say, right? Like, not the CEO selling it, but, the watchdogs, right? The actual researchers and those. And I think that's what we need to start having those conversations, and not the CEO and founder worships, right? Because they have that agenda to sell software. And they're always going to tell you the rosy and positive. I mean, Zuck, right? Zuck invented the social media as we know it. Now he's also pushing AI, and you're seeing what's happening in Threads, right? Like, the pattern's repeating itself.
Well, it's a good, I think the pattern recognition is really important there, and the critical thinking. It's funny, I put up an article on the World Economic Forum, put out basically what they called the Future of Jobs report. And in there, they're about page 30, 31, there's an indicator of, like, here are the core skills that all of the companies that we talked with, or at least some percentage, right? So the highest consensus was, like, almost 80%. Number one thing was analytical thinking. That's their number one core skill. All top 10 of the core skills that they desired are all non-technical. And then you have a contrast with, like, well, what things are growing? Well, certainly AI and big data was growing at number one, but it's not one of the top 10 required core skills according to the businesses, saying, like, those things are important. They have their place, but we need to get back to reality as to how are we actually going to move forward. And I read an article yesterday that just talked about it, gave a simple equation that said, look, ultimately it's AI plus HI, which is human ingenuity, that are going to create the ROI. And any scenario that doesn't have the HI in the equation is destined to fail. And we, as those who are going to bring that human ingenuity, right? We have to keep our own mental strength, stamina, curiosity up it to a very high degree. And to your point about experts, I don't know if you've seen it, there's actually a report from Salesforce has data scientists on staff, and they analyze their own success and failure rates related to Agentforce. And they're abysmal. It's like single task success rates are roughly 30%. And multitask success rates are under 15%, right? And this is the internal, I mean, this is them reporting on themselves. So I'm glad they put out, but there was no press release, It wasn't anything to Mark's talking about on the news, right? Which would be great because they're trying to sell all of this. And to your point, I totally appreciate it. Imagine if you're working on Service Cloud or on Sales Cloud, and you're coming out with all these amazing innovations and nobody wants to talk about it. But that's really what companies need. Like, they need this other horizontal, these other tools on the platform that they've paid for. There's so much benefit in all of those elements.
I'm glad you brought up the internal research and that, right? Because I laugh, right? Because I saw that article come out. I read it and was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. The next day I woke up on LinkedIn, right? And there was a large group going, well, the research was flawed. Like they didn't do it correctly. And I just sat there to myself, John, and went like, okay, the research was flawed. They didn't use the tool correctly that they invented.
Exactly. It's their own
Like,
tool.
take off the blinders, people. Like, don't defend them carte blanche. Like, I get it. You love AI, you love Salesforce. Cool. It's okay. But push back a little bit, right? And go, what's again the motivation here, right? Because if their own research is saying that and they invented the tool, like, don't you think they would have made the study make it more favorable? It goes back to like Mark saying, oh, 30% of our company is more efficient because they're using AI. Dude, I've been in software a long time. I know engineers. If people are doing that and that's that cool and saving that much time, they're at every conference, blogging,
Talking about it.
podcasts, raving about it. Where is the metrics? Also, have you noticed every single company says 30 to 50%, not 20 to 30, not 50 to 70. Everyone says 30 to 50%. Okay, cool. Like maybe that's just what AI does, but how are they doing these studies? Are they bringing in workforce professionals who are doing actual time studies and blinds, right? Or are people just going, well, I see that 30% of our email is generated by AI now, right? Like that's not a metric that we would drive. Like if you're managing your company, right, and you're going to your performance review and you're a finance or your CRO, right, and you go to a rep and they go, I increased pipeline by 30%. Well, show me how. Well, it's special. Like it just doesn't add up, right?
Yeah, well, to complement that, I mean, I think, MIT is pretty good at number crunching. And they've
Yeah,
had
a
two
little bit.
reports come out now, right? Highlighting, they were the one first one to come out and talk about cognitive decline for those who use ChatGPT extensively. And that goes to my point. I was highlighting, that people get the sense of knowing without the labor of learning, which is not good because you actually don't know anything. And they also came up with the showing research showing less than 10% of corporate AI projects have any impact on P&L. So look, these guys know what they're doing. They lay out their, like their whole methodology and everything, which is a lot more than, if you look at the private closed AI models, they don't disclose like how they're coming up with some of these revenue numbers. They're coming up with very, very unique ways. There's a guy I follow. It's a blog called Where's Your Ed At? I'll put it in the show notes. But it's the article is called AI is a Money Trap, and I learned more about kind of the background behind the curtain in that article. It was incredible because it's totally unsustainable. You're exactly right. They cannot exist unless they either start selling our privacy, or they just consolidate, right, ultimately. But before we go, we just have a few more minutes. I'm curious as to I've been doing a bit of work with helping companies own their AI pipelines. And this goes to open source AI. So you may have heard of the Swiss Initiative that came out in the last 2 weeks. You know, you made it for Qwen or DeepSeek. Or China is actually leading in a significant way with open source AI right now. But I'm curious kind of what your thoughts are on that. And I love the fact that, the Trump administration made open source AI a primary tenet of the AI plan. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that subject.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge open source person, right? Like I was installing Linux boxes, right? Back in high school, right? So like Linus Torvalds, right? Driving open source. I don't think he's the inventor, but most famous, right? And the MIT license and Apache license and all of that. So and shout out, right, to all the open sourcers in the Salesforce community who have emerged, greatly over the last 6 years.
But even Salesforce themselves, I mean, the whole SFDX suite, all their MCP server, like there's so much you can do with a little Copilot like client inside VS Code using all of that, right?
And so I'm a big fan of open source. What I think, though, is the difference is code open source, right? Like anybody, for the most part, right, can write Python. Like, yeah, you have to be there's certain levels, right, or Ruby, right? And you can understand it. I think AI engineering is a little different. And so people don't really understand the code, right? Like when they go back and read it, is there anything being injected, right? Is anything happening? We're even seeing that in open source packages today, right? Where AI is, or people with AI, we have no idea how to code, right? Or injecting bad packages, right? That can, go into your code base and steal stuff, right? And so I think open source is the other side of that coin, right? Where I talked about, like, don't trust the private people because they can do whatever they want. But also with open source, it works because you can understand it. And I think it's great. I think the other challenge with those open source models is compute power, right? Like it's great to say you have open source, but to run it locally, like can your device handle it, right? Like can you actually push out that power? If you're a corporation, right? Like how much does it cost to run that open model versus buy, something from OpenAI? And so I think that's the big trade-off, right? Is open source has always been a very much, compared to hosted, right? Like yeah, I have hardware cost, right? I have to, upgrade that server, or container, right? Whatever. But AI open models, I think, are a lot bigger of a magnitude, right? Because you are having to set up all that security internally. You don't have that expertise, right? You can't afford an AI engineer who might understand it. So I think it's a great thing for researchers. It's going to continue to advance, right? Like the fact that we're doing it now, like means engineers can dive in and learn. But I don't think it's the most biggest offset against, corporate AI. But I'm very, very positive that it'll eventually, close the gap. But I think it's the compute power that holds us back right now.
Yeah, well, this is certainly a third option there is using Grok like GROQ and AWS SageMaker. You can use DigitalOcean. All of these enable you to set up without having to own any of your own hardware. You can just spin up your own infrastructure, turn on your own model, create your own kind of secure pipeline, which should alleviate some of that. But it is trading costs a little bit, right? So instead of paying OpenAI for their compute, right? You're going to pay, your own provider for your compute, but you can set up your own secure pipelines and such. So it's interesting. So we'll see how it grows. But certainly it's a good kind of counterbalance to the closed models because I mean, you think about the Swiss, I think is it Aspyrus? I forget the name. But they were able to build an 80 billion parameter model in stark contrast to right the OpenAIs of the world without actually having to steal anybody's intellectual property. They stole nobody's books. They stole nobody's visualizations. And the reason we know this is they make all of their training data public. And they have post-training operations that enable people to be forgotten. If you want to pull yourself out of the model, there's a method to do that. And so just from the presence of those things, hopefully it gets people, and for our audience, it gets people recognizing that we don't have to settle for whatever the Sam Altmans of the world tell us that we have to settle for. And the same is true with Mark and Agentforce. We don't have to settle because someone says this is the way they do it, and therefore this is what you get. It's not like I tell my kids, right, that you get what you get and you don't get upset. You don't have to take those options in the marketplace today. Which is a very good thing. And I think that knowledge is power so that people can understand the horizon that they're dealing with. Well, excellent. It's great to hear your story. Thank you much for your service. and both in the past and as you continue. Any final thoughts before we sign off today?
Yeah, I would just say, having, my new transition, right? Same as always, right? Been laid off twice in 2 years in tech, and I said, hey, this time's not the time again, right? So I'm gonna take a bet on myself. So, same kind of space, right? Being at Right Size Tech, my org, right? And trying to buy, convince people, right? And mentor them to say, like, hey, you don't need all of this extra software because the market says it, right? Like, let's look at your actual need and save that cost. So you don't spend that on software and you can spend that on your people, right? Like, make sure, because every dollar and every piece of software you buy means that that's possibly money, right, that you can't afford a salary on. So just staying that conscience, right? Making sure people get the right tools and have the right, status and stuff out there. So hanging up my shingle, it's the scariest thing I've done, and I've been in combat. So it's also exciting, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, so help us understand a little bit of, are you still working with salespeople who have Salesforce? And then what else? Like, what other kind of tech stack or aspects, like business size? Help us understand what your targets are.
Yeah, so looking at the SMB and mid-market space, mainly looking, across the stack, right, as I always have, from finance, to quote to cash to Salesforce, even other CRMs out there, and then AI readiness, right? Not just in, like, hey, do you have metadata fields, but do you understand what AI is? Do you know that you can experiment a little bit with AI internally and realize, its pros and cons in an automated fashion, right? Like, maybe don't put it on your financials, right? Because you can't control it as well and have financial controls. And then just personally, like, helping out the small business owner who leaves a flyer on my door that has their website, and then I'm emailing Joe Smith at Gmail, right? And being able to say, like, yeah, you can actually have a professional email domain and it doesn't cost you anything, right? And so that's what it is. It's mainly just helping folks out there who are kind of lost, right, in the ecosystem. They know they need tools, but they don't know where to start. And, knowing that you can bring somebody on me who's actually affordable and can save you money over the long term.
Cool.
It's all about the humans.
Well, yeah, excited. I agree, man. It's people first, and welcome to the independent professional world. You're gonna love it. And there's nothing like having a 1099 based contract, right, where you can negotiate anything you like in that contract versus a fixed W-2 that comes with a ton of overhead and expectations that you don't have the ability to negotiate through because you have to be like everybody else. So I think you're
Ability
gonna
to
love
say
it.
no. Yep.
Yes, yeah, the ability to say no, it's really big. And then to say, well, yes, if, right? If these things are true. So congrats. It's a great milestone. Really appreciate your time today and just learning about your story.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials. If you found this episode valuable, we would love your help reaching others. Please subscribe. Leave us a 5-star review and share this with another who would benefit.